Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. And I apologize, I've got a little audio going on in the background here. Let me try that again. Live to see it, friends. You're listening. By the way, George, that was it, okay?
That was the glitch.
Just before the program, we were explaining about our weekly technical glitch.
Well, let's hope that that's the worst of it.
That's it. Yeah, no, we're through it now. Okay, so let me try that one more time. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm super fantastic. I'm really enjoying our theme music. It was kind of echoing there. I was getting the reverb, and I couldn't make the laptop be quiet.
That was a new one. I don't think we've ever had that particular glitch. We've had everything else. Well, I should never say that. I should knock on wood now. There's always a possibility of new and interesting glitches, but that was a first on that one.
Well, the thing is, we've cycled through quite a few. I mean, some of them we've had two or three times now, but that's a brand new one. And I think the new ones are getting, it's like finding a new prime number, right? They don't come along as often, right? They're out there, but it takes longer to get to them. Before I bring out our guest, I want to acknowledge our chat host, Michael Darling, who has unfortunately had to go on hiatus and will not be on the program for the foreseeable future. So I just want to take a moment to thank him for his, gosh, what's it been, more than a year, I guess, now, Stephen. How long has he been?
Absolutely.
Yeah, doing
the show. He's been doing it at least a year, more like a year and a half. He actually co-hosted the show a few times as well, blogged some at The Speculist, and I'm sure he'll continue to do that. But, I mean, we really appreciate his service to the show and his contributions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great. Michael, you're welcome back anytime. Thanks so much for being part of the show, and you're welcome back anytime you want to come back. Well, let's bring out our guest. Our guest is a consultant and award-winning blogger who writes and speaks extensively about the impacts of cutting-edge science and technology, particularly as they pertain to the improvement of human performance and experience. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Institute of Ethics and Emerging Technologies and Humanity Plus, and he blogs at Sentient Developments. George Dvorsky, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, we only got to chat so briefly back, what was that, in November of last year at Convergence 08, and we kept saying we've got to have you on for a full hour one of these days.
I was just reflecting on that, and that was a rather neat experience because there we were at Convergence, and it was a very busy atmosphere, and you had set up in the whole studio in the hallway there, and it was actually quite an amazing sight, and that you, again, you had people kind of coming in and out of there for brief interviews and to getting on the radio live. It was quite extraordinary, and it was a great experience. So, again, thanks for having me back for the full hour.
Yeah, well, it was loads of fun doing that at Convergence. Of course, our glitch there was that Skype was causing an audio delay between what we were saying to each other and what we were hearing in our headsets. So it took this real kind of intense, keen powers of concentration in order to be able to say anything coherent.
Right.
Of course, I never have to worry about anything like that, but for the guests, you know, people, you know, they had expectations, so we had to keep that
right.
going. Well, George was going to be a guest during our special summer series, The World Transformed, and unfortunately, life intervened and made that impossible. But, George, since we've got you here with us, we thought we'd go ahead and ask you the same two World Transformed questions that we sprung on all the rest of our guests, if you're game for that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's begin with the first one, which is, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime?
Well, I thought about this question, and I imagine there are some, converging answers to this, and I was trying to think of something perhaps a little out of the box, and maybe you can tell me if my answer is exactly that or not. But I got thinking in terms of what has really changed in terms of, not necessarily from a technological perspective, but from a broader, let's say, sociological or a political perspective, such that there may be ramifications to technological development, any other kind of development in the future. And for me, I think over the course of my lifetime, having been born in 1970, at the time of the Cold War and being really raised to know nothing other than the Cold War and to know what the Iron Curtain was about and to learn about the two different systems, the totalitarian communist system and, of course, the capitalist system or the democratic system that we have here. So for me, I would say it is the not just the end of the Cold War, but really the ramification of the end of the Cold War, which has been globalization. And by globalization, I mean economic globalization, political globalization, and cultural globalization as well. Those have had rather sweeping impacts since the early 90s on pretty much every corner of the globe. And from a cultural perspective, for example, there's been certainly a homogenization of culture. But I think when you look a little closer, there's also been a rather remarkable exchange of culture as well, a lot of mimetic exchange and a lot of hybridization of different cultural aspects, which I think has enriched many of our lives and has kind of added to culture itself. And, of course, we have really, really seen the impacts of economic globalization with everything from the negative consequences through to the positive consequences. The negative consequences, of course, being things like factories shutting down here in the so-called developed world and moving elsewhere and just seeing the shifts in employment and work, but also seeing, for example, what have been traditionally known as the have-not countries suddenly starting to emerge a little bit, trying to catch up to the developed world, starting to have, for example, better standards of living, higher wages, greater access to health and medical technologies, and I think that cannot be understated. And, of course, with political globalization, that's probably been the tardiest of all of them, as there hasn't really been too much of an impetus or a trajectory in terms of where the political systems are headed. The United Nations, certainly in my lifetime, has not really had too much credibility, associated with it. It doesn't seem that it's going to happen anytime soon. But what we have seen, perhaps in that regard, is strengthening transnational organizations, greater cooperation between nation states. When it comes to trade, for example, and this again ties back to the economic part of the globalization, just seeing that there's less protectionism, freer borders in terms of mobility, and of course the extraordinary development happening in Europe, which I'd have never guessed in my lifetime, the emergence of the European Union, which is pretty much a de facto nation state unto itself. Mind you, they've got problems currently trying to get a constitution together and trying to get some things ironed out. But, of course, the emergence of the euro and all of the sharing of, for example, police services and other such institutions has been quite tremendous. And, again, so that for me has been the most extraordinary thing. And in terms of what that might mean looking forward, and, again, this will tie in definitely to the futurist theme here, is that we always do tend to think, particularly us as the positivist futurists, that these are all quite good things when we have a convergence, when we bring and unify people together, when we have people cooperating rather than being antagonistic towards each other. And looking even further afield, having, for example, really linked, super linked political systems and economic systems, and even having individuals themselves just becoming more intimate, more connected, and not having those barriers, whether they be economic, political, or cultural, be in the way and act as inhibitors. So that's how I think that's for me the most profound thing I've seen in my lifetime.
Well, that's a great answer. I couldn't disagree with any of that. I think that as I'm listening to you talk, I look back over my own life. Since Stephen, you and I never really got a chance to answer these questions, I think I might actually go with the same answer, that the end of the Cold War and just the amazing. If one were not to go with the obvious technology, the internet answer, which came up more often than not, that really is an excellent just kind of summary of how the world has changed in our lifetimes. And I think about the the economic and the political aspect all very well, but that it's that cultural side of it that I think is the most interesting when you go forward, and maybe not even so much, I don't know if this falls under the rubric of the political or not, but just the death of distance and the ability for people to have relationships irrespective of distance, which to me is kind of this powerful thing that's been enabled by the technology, but it's an aspect of this globalization that you're talking about, right? I mean, here the three of us are talking, Louisiana, Colorado, and I'm sorry, what city in
Toronto.
Canada? Or Toronto, okay. Yeah, you know, and the fact that that people are making friendships, making real connections, and forming new kinds of communities, irrespective of previous existing geographic and
yes.
political and cultural boundaries, I think is really interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, globalization, I think, is a key. Not only, you know, when you bring down the trade barriers, it enriches both countries, which a lot of people still don't understand, but why it works that way, but it does. And then you tend not to go to war with people that you're, you know, trying to sell your goods to. So it has a way of encouraging peace as well. So
or even that you're playing World of Warcraft with.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Instead of going to war, you play Quake. You know, with somebody
or
in another
Halo,
country.
You know, whatever it is.
Whatever you need to do, but you don't actually shoot real bullets at each other.
Exactly.
So.
Let's move on to part two, Steve.
Okay. Oh, well, he sort of answered looking forward, Phil.
Was that the greatest transformation you expect, or were you just turning that?
That wasn't. I guess I did touch on what we can expect, but that wasn't going to be my answer. At the risk, I suppose, of throwing in some spoilers, given what our conversation is going to be about over the next 45 minutes or so. What I was going to
say... Oh, we're huge on spoilers on this show. Go right ahead.
if
you know the end of... what's that movie coming out, Surrogates? Go ahead, give us the end. We're ready. Whatever you
mean. Actually, I'm actually looking forward to seeing that in a strange sort of way. But anyways, for me, I guess the question is, if I remember correctly, is what is the most profound, I guess, technological advancement or change that I would hope to anticipate?
Yeah, what's the biggest transformation you anticipate seeing,
right,
if different from the one you've already answered?
And
yeah.
It is different, and it for me, I think, and again, I hope that this will happen within my lifetime, but ultimately it will be to see the transition of the human species from a purely biological species through to a completely non-biological species or entity. And that can take on many different forms. Obviously, it can mean everything from when I say non-biological, that can mean everything from the advent of cybernetic technologies through to the introduction of molecular nanotechnology, namely medical nanotechnology, and even more profoundly, leaving the kind of biological or corporeal existence that we've known, rejecting that altogether and entering into the so-called, the downloading, or rather the uploading of consciousness into a supercomputer or some kind of digital substrate where existence would be completely outside of, the biological sphere. That would obviously be a sea change, to say the least, but I think that's ultimately the trajectory we are headed in. I think that the whole point of the whole transhumanist endeavor and really the acknowledgement of it is that we have gotten, and again, you guys are certainly advocates of this and you've spoken about this numerous times, is that basically Darwinian processes have gotten us to where we're at today, and now that we've recognized that and we can start to modify ourselves and to implement certain types of technologies to change ourselves, that it would seem that the next logical course of action is to basically stop Darwinian selection in its tracks and say, we're going to take over from here and we're going to move on. And that will necessitate, I think, the ending of biological, of, let's say, meat processing and using tissue and all the sort of electrochemicals that are resident in our minds and our bodies, and replacing them with synthetic analogs of some sort that are more durable, more resilient, more robust, will enable greater capacities, and again, we're going to get into this over the course of the next little while. But just to kind of cut myself off there, that's pretty much it, I think, just the migration of the human species from a biological species to a non-biological one.
You know,
well,
I, Oh, go ahead, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that's interesting because at the same time, presumably, we'll be learning how to fix the limitations of biology. So, you know, if, for example, Aubrey de Grey's SINS program works out, you know, we don't have to get old. We can live in a biological body indefinitely. And so that, you know, so you're talking about, you know, humanity moving towards being a machine race, and then Aubrey's going in a different direction. Could be that we pick and choose or move back and forth or we go with a hybrid.
And I don't necessarily disagree with what Aubrey is suggesting there. I just think that some of the remedies or some of the prescriptions for aging may not have a purely biological solution. I think there might be limits to how much we can thwart, let's say, aging cells, or how much we can deal with, let's say, senescing neurons and so on, that we may have to, out of just sheer necessity, replace them with synthetic analogs. And anytime you do that, again, and perhaps those could be biological synthetics, just of a different nature. But again, just imagining the body infused with nanotechnology in particular, thinking about the future, for example, of materials technology and what that might mean in terms of introducing those both into and outside our bodies, I just can't see us, at least not all of us, again, I hate to overgeneralize, and that's one of the dangers of this type of discussion. And this is, I think, what you were speaking to as well, is that certainly certain segments of humanity may choose, again, to remain purely biological, and that's completely fine. And of course, there's the whole world as well of genetic enhancements and genetic modification. But I do also suspect that just given what possibilities exist in terms of the non-biological, that it'll probably be a bit more, I guess, persuasive or a bit more meaningful, I suppose, to completely, to enter into that realm rather than stay in the biological.
Well, John Smart was on 3-4 weeks ago, and he was talking about this moment of kind of syncing up, this moment of when the he doesn't talk so much about uploading as he talks about this this sort of digital twin which has achieved greater than human intelligence, allowing us to kind of share some of its cognitive process and sync ourselves up with it and become kind of
right.
This virtual version of ourselves. And at the point that happens, you're suddenly going 6 million times faster than you were down in your mosh brain, down in your meat space brain. And I don't know. I just think that's going to win out. I have a feeling that I'll prefer going 6 million times faster to
That's an excellent point. And the whole clock speed issue, and the rate of processing your environment issue. And given that the brain is computational, this whole functional paradigm that we're now moving towards, we have every reason to believe, as you suggested, that we can experience a whole lot more in a drastically reduced period of time. And once you're actually exposed to that, getting out of that pace, if you will, would probably be quite excruciating and pointless. And I think the tendency to want to stay in that particular mind space would be rather overwhelming.
Right. Now, the other point I would make is, having said that while I would agree with you that biology will stop being the evolutionary path forward for us, biological evolution will continue because I think for us as a hybrid organic machine species or as a purely machine species or whatever we end up being, biology remains this incredible canvas on which we'll be able to do all kinds of really neat stuff in terms of even restoring species that have been lost, trying out new stuff that evolution never got to try before, and preserving what's already here.
Well, you've now introduced a whole other topic that I don't think that given the scope of today's episode would do it justice, but that's a whole, the idea of, for example, re-engineering the ecosystem and the biosphere and reshaping animals in the way, for example, as we see fit, or whether that be reintroducing extinct animals or altering their particular makeup, there's a lot of space in that particular area to start to speculate about. There's the whole, for example, hedonistic imperative, whether or not, for example, we should engineer animals such that they're incapable of experiencing suffering, for example, and re-engineering the ecosystem such that predation would be a thing of the past, or if that predation were to continue to exist, it would be, for example, predators that would not be hunting actual prey, but there'd be some kind of a substitute for that. So this is it's a huge topic, but it's certainly something that is worth discussing. In terms of its linkage to Darwinian processes, though, I think ultimately, and at least from my particular perspective, I'm definitely a post-Darwinian. I think that Darwinian processes as an autonomous process, as one that doesn't have any kind of overseer, is definitely something we need to decommission, because it's a trial and error process that results in a lot of suffering. The amount of suffering that goes on in the natural world is astronomical, and I don't think any of us can even begin to grasp the scale right now. And I think that mission number one, of course, and again, not that I wish to prioritize the human species in any sort of a way, but once we can deal with our own issues, get our house in order, and deal with our own levels of suffering, then I think the next logical extension will be to extend outwards into the animal kingdom and to start wondering about things like animal uplift, which, again, that's something I've written about in the past. And again, this whole hedonistic imperative idea to apply it outside of the human species as well. So some pretty radical stuff. But again, this is the sort of thing that I think is definitely par for the course in terms of what we think of as a post-Darwinian existence in every sense of the term, so that there is no more natural selection, that there is, I guess, there will always be selection. You're absolutely true about that. Even the human species in any kind of futuristic form will still have to suffer through selectional processes. But the fact is that what we want to reduce the amount of, I guess, arbitrary trial and error type situations that, I guess, it will lead to undue suffering.
Absolutely. Okay. Great points, George. And I'll tell you what. Next time we have you on, let's spend some time getting a little deeper into that. That's a really interesting little diversion we took right there. But now we're going to talk about reworking the human architecture, which was our original topic on the world transformed. And I want to start out just talking. Let's work our way up in terms of talking about human enhancement. We'll start out with just everything that's around today, and a lot of it is not even particularly controversial. Arguably all technology is an extension of human capability. So your calculator or your bike or your car provides an enhancement to what you were able to do. And we've got cognitive enhancement available via, nutraceuticals, which may or may not be doing anything, or stuff like caffeine, which definitely empowers and enables my entire life. and you got things like physical enhancement through diet and exercise, and then there's stuff like surgery or tattoo or piercing or those kinds of things. Now, the
eyeglasses,
question is, good one. Eyeglasses, hearing aids, right? That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
Is there a tipping point coming when enhancements will be widely practiced and broadly accepted in any of the following three areas? Extending physical abilities, from within organically, right? Extending cognitive abilities or modifying our appearance. Is that going to, do you see that suddenly taking off at some point, hitting a knee of a curve? And if so, what do you think will drive us in that direction?
I don't see a tipping point per se, although I do appreciate what you mean by that. And I think it makes you wonder, at what point are we going to finally get it, so to speak, and it'll be welcome within the regular routines of what we do to ourselves, whether it be the kinds of things the doctors say is okay to engage in, or whether just even culturally it's okay to go about this. What I think is, instead what happens is it's a rather long and hard and arduous path of cultural and social normalization. I think, in other words, it's going to be a battle every step of the way. Every new enhancement or every new modification is going to be received with that shock. And it'll take, I suppose, is time to be able to get over that. And I think one of the differentiating factors between some of the technologies that you were just describing now that are already within our grasp versus those that are coming down the pipe are that these are the technologies that are going to supposedly be the differentiators in terms of our giving us an edge, a decided edge, so to speak, over those who are not augmented. See, right now, if I wear a pair of glasses, for example, it's not really enhancement in that sense. I'm just able to keep up with the next guy who doesn't really need glasses. In terms of, let's say, caffeine intake, that's just going to make me a bit more alert. It's going to make me less prone to be drowsy and again, maybe it might even make me sharp if I'm taking an energy drink, so to speak. Again, in terms of scale, it's very minute in terms of the advantage that's giving me over some guy, let's say, who refuses to drink caffeine and remains drowsy all day. Even, for example, things like access to certain educational systems. And again, this has always been a debate, for example, of people that are on the below the poverty line have poor access to education versus those who are well above the poverty line. They get the best education. They're more equipped in life to succeed. There's one example where one could make an argument that there already is a sort of decided advantage for those sorts of individuals. So the kinds of, I guess, technology that we're talking about, and I always like to look at sports as an example because I think sports, and we're going to get to this eventually as well with the whole Castro Semenya controversy,
right,
is that we look at sports, I suppose, as somewhat as a mirror of society or at the very least being somehow representative of society. We have, you know, athletic competitions, whether it be one-on-one or team sports or what have you, and we like to think that everybody's on a level playing field and that really all that you're really bringing in there is you're not bringing in your genetics with you. That's really you don't ever hear that sort of discussion, although we all know it's true. We all know that athletes, when they come in there, they clearly have certain physical advantages that others don't have, regardless of how hard they train, regardless of what kind of attitude they bring into the event and so on. But that's the myth we cling to. The myth is that we have a level playing field. The athletes, they enter their arena, and again, it's just sheer willpower and just their determination that's going to decide the winner. And it's somewhat of a delusion that we live under. And what's happening now, of course, is that we're seeing all these attempts to cheat, I suppose, to have the sorts of enhancements in those events that are going to give people the edge over their competitors. So, for example, in terms of speaking of the kinds of physical enhancements, there's gene doping, where you can quite literally impact on your genetic constitution by giving yourself a trait that you didn't have before that will give you an advantage. So, for example, you've heard the whole thing about slow twitch fibers and fast twitch fibers. Well, perhaps you could give yourself a genetic mod such that you finally have the one that's best suited for your sport. Or let's say you give yourself a genetic modification that allows you, in the way that, for example, Michael Phelps, he can do quite naturally, is he can oxygenate, his blood oxygenates much quicker, so he can hold his breath for much longer. He doesn't suffer from the cardio problems that, let's say, other swimmers have. So what the thing is that once you try to introduce these sorts of, enhancements or advancements in sports, it becomes a real tricky area. And again, like I said, it's sort of a mirror on the rest of society. So if I start to, for example, really modify my intelligence and my memory, and then I enter into the workforce, that's the moment you're going to have that kind of that backtalk, that social criticism, that now I'm doing something that's simply not fair to the rest of society. And again, just to kind of circle back to the whole point of your question, that's why I think that there won't necessarily be a tipping point per se. It's simply going to have to be something that we deal with on a piecemeal basis. We have to work on such things as accessibility, on safety, on understanding what it is that we're actually doing to ourselves, and just make it, I guess, as fair and non-arbitrary as possible.
We had a question in the chat room. The question's asked, should we try to do anything to keep the playing field level, or is that a fool's game? What do we do about that?
It's a question that I struggle with. I'm inclined, I always hate to be conservative when it comes to these things and to rail against, I suppose, what can be deemed as being somewhat inevitable. I'm a big sports fan. I watch lots of different sorts of sports, and for me personally, I like to see sports engaged in at the most competitive level possible. I want to see the best against the best and so on. And I personally, as long as it's safe, and again, for me, it really does become an issue of safety, which is why, for example, I'm very much opposed to steroids, because steroids does some awful, awful things to the human body, and I think it's all fine and well that it is, in fact, a banned substance. But if, for example, there was an equivalent to steroids that did exactly what it's supposed to do but was completely harmless, then, to be honest with you, I don't think I would have as much of a problem against it as I do now. I think that athletes, they, like the rest of people in society, and again, this is what I was referring to earlier when we have this double standard about athletics and society, is that we don't allow our athletes to do certain things, but in regular society we can. So if we can't allow our athletes to modify and augment themselves, then why would we not in regular society be not allowed to augment and modify ourselves? And I'll give you kind of a banal example. But I don't know if many people don't know this, but caffeine is actually a banned substance in sports. you cannot be tested positive for caffeine because that's considered an enhancement. But in the rest of society, I can have as much coffee or a Red Bull as I want to give myself the same sort of an edge that an athlete arguably is seeking for themselves in their particular line of work. So it's this double standard that that has to end, I suppose. And to answer the person's question in the chat room, then I suppose yes. In order to help move sports along, and sports, they do evolve, they do change. The nature of the athletes change as well, and that results in the changing of rules and how the games are played. Then let's do that. It's going to be quite interesting. I'm very much looking forward to the future of sports, both in terms of what the physical body will be able to do given medical enhancements, but also in conjunctions with some new technologies like augmented reality and other sorts of advancements as well. So bring it on,
so, SA. George, just to clarify, based on the scenarios you've laid out, is it fair to say that your expectation is that enhancements will primarily show up through a process of adults enhancing different aspects of their physiology or of their mental abilities rather than, say, designer babies who have been wholly genetically reformulated to have better performance or that kind of thing? Or does one come before the other, or do they come at the same time, or what do you think?
I think they will be convergent. It's a very good question. I think perhaps in terms of cultural normalization, perhaps it'll be through just seeing adults do to themselves first. That will give people, I suppose, a bit more that will alleviate some of their concerns. But that said, I don't think it's going to follow too far behind the whole idea of designer, so-called designer babies. The reason I believe that is that I think that's really right around the corner, only because the first thing that's going to happen will be the elimination of all these genetic-based diseases. Recent polls, particularly in the United States, show that I think it was around 15%, perhaps I'll have to recheck my source here. It might be as high as 30%, but I'm going to stick with the 15% just to be safe. Of prospective parents said that they would in fact use genetic technologies to screen for not just genetic-based diseases in their offspring, but to also screen for other characteristics such as intelligence, physical aptitude, memory, and so on. And that might not seem like a lot of people, but given that there are millions and millions of people born each year, and given that we're talking about at least 15% of the people wanting to actually use that, that tells me there's already demand for the so-called designer baby. So we're just on the cusp, I think, of that particular hurdle there. And then that will, again, work to further normalize these sorts of modifications. You know, it's going to pretty much be part of the culture of how you go about having a baby. Before you conceive, for example, you will go visit your fertility clinic, and you're going to talk to your doctor there, and he or she are going to advise you on all the sorts of things that can happen, the things that you can go about in such a way to guarantee that your future child is going to have or not have certain characteristics. And again, one would hope that these are going to be sanctioned modifications. There's going to be a very strict book, I suppose, of what is allowable and not allowable. In particular, the tricky area will be in determining what is a genetic disease and what is not a genetic disease, for example. So one could, for example, say if there was, for example, a link between autism and genetics, would you say, for example, that autism or Asperger's is a genetic-based disease? Well, I, for one, for example, would have a hard time accepting that. I don't particularly think that that is a disease that needs to be screened for. And you can see why now there's going to be some movement on both sides for different sorts of diseases that are going to be potentially problematic in terms of us screening or not screening. And I'm sorry, I think I'm digressing a little bit here, so I'm going to throw it back to you guys at this point.
Okay, no, I think that's an excellent point. Well, and what you see is eventually it turns a corner, and it's not just, for one thing, 15%, hearing that statistic, yeah, 15% admit it, right? You know, I have a hard time believing that that it's that low, to tell you the truth. I think most people, actually realistically given the choice, would screen for diseases for their children. You know, I mean, it's a natural, almost instinctive thing. And when you get into this setting, this scenario where other people are having children and they know they don't have to worry about those problems, that creates a tremendous social pressure. You know, I mean, not that anyone's going to feel like they have to do it because someone else is telling them to, but just because it's like, well, I don't want to face that risk if no one else is, if it's not necessary anymore. It seems to me you hit a turning point on that one pretty fast. But then when you take it to the next step, and it's not just preventing diseases, but it's you know, making sure they reach a certain height or, you know, whatever it might be, or, you know, musical ability or a certain IQ. When those things can be programmed in, that is that's a whole different ballgame. But I think that probably that comes along fairly fast, too, once a few of them slip through.
I think that at some point in the process, society begins to look at it as child abuse not to prevent disease.
Yeah,
to prevent disease. And then at some point, we get so used to, kids that are smarter or have certain abilities that we look at it as child abuse to not give them those abilities as well. I think that we wring our hands over things that we can't do. Once we can do them, we accommodate.
Yeah.
That is such an excellent point. Here's another scenario, for example, is let's say you're a child born in the future and your parents opted not, for example, to deal, let's say, while you were in utero with a particular genetic condition. You end up developing some kind of a condition, and then you, in retrospect, then sue your parents for negligence that they should have done that. And in other words, the whole, I guess, legalistic aspect of here as well is going to be rather significant. And there might be actually, as you suggested, maybe not child abuse, but maybe that's actually what it is, but certainly that there may be a certain sense of obligation for parents to actually engage in these sorts of interventions.
The wrongful life lawsuit only. It's the wrongful non-enhancement, right? Wrongful state of quality of life, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's look at this Caster Semenya controversy. Just very quickly, catch us up on that.
Sure.
I know you blogged about it over at Sentient Developments.
Yeah.
What is going on there with that?
Well, it's a fascinating story. A number of, I'm not sure it was weeks or months ago, but a South African runner by the name of Caster Semenya, 18-year-old, running as a female. I believe her particular discipline was 400-meter dash or 1,000, I can't remember now, but it was one of the short-distance running events and rather dominant results and apparently as well some really quick improvement time, so it kind of raised suspicion a little bit. But I think what really raised suspicion was just this general sense that people had that, well, and again, without sounding too politically incorrect, she just didn't seem, you know, womanly enough. So what they decided to do was have her undergo a battery of gender tests. And as uncomfortable as it was for them to admit that, and it's not something that is all too rare. It is done from time to time when an athlete's gender is somewhat ambiguous. They do undergo the tests, and in this case, the results. I don't know if the results are official quite yet. I know that what happened a few weeks ago was that the results leaked, and the I believe it was an Australian press or maybe even a South African paper that first published the leaked reports, and it just exploded out of there. What the report suggested was that Caster Semenya is indeed an intersexed individual, which means that she has both characteristics of males and females. In her particular case, she has no ovaries, has no capacity to reproduce, and instead has internal testes that are, in fact, producing testosterone, perhaps on the same level that a natural man would be producing. And as we all know, testosterone is a very important ingredient in building muscle mass. And that it now poses a rather interesting ethical dilemma for the IAAF, who have yet to come down with a decision on this. And when I say coming down with a decision, what they have to decide is, one, do they take away her gold medal and her achievements? And, or two, what do they now do in terms of her ability, or right, if you will, to be able to compete against other women in the future? And this has been quite scandalous and quite controversial. In South Africa, the country has rallied behind Caster because she did not know. She simply did not know that this was her condition. So this is another tricky part of this whole case, is that there was never any intention on her part to cheat. She's just a runner doing what she does best. Unlike, you know, a doping scandal where there's definitely intent. So that's...
Well, I mean, here's the comparison, right? Manny Ramirez has higher testosterone level than everybody else in Major League Baseball, right? He's cheating, okay? Here you've got this woman. She's got higher testosterone level than all the women she's running against, but she hasn't done anything wrong, right? I mean, it's baffling.
And you've now struck at the heart of the issue, and that is, if the IAAF, for example, come down hard and say, no, we cannot allow you to run against women because you have this kind of quote-unquote natural advantage, is that now opens a real Pandora's box of problems? Because now what you're saying is, look, there actually can be natural traits. You've won a genetic lottery in some sort of a way, but you know what? It's just too good. It's just too good. It's too not fair. And again, back to what we were describing about that level playing field, is that your natural advantage has now completely put that level playing field off kilter. And you used the example of Manny Ramirez. The example that I used in my article was that of Michael Phelps. Again, an earlier article that I'd written was entitled Michael Phelps is the Natural Transhuman Athlete. And I went on to describe every freakishly fortuitous trait that he has, everything from his short 6-foot frame, but he has the wingspan of a 6-foot-4 long person, through to his ability to, as I suggested earlier, he can oxygenate blood at a much more efficient rate and hold his breath longer. Apparently, he's even got webbing on his fingers. I mean, everything you could possibly, if you wanted to design the perfect swimmer, you'd design Michael Phelps.
Right.
But he came upon it, quote unquote, fairly. In other words, he won the genetic lottery. But if we, for example, now don't allow Castor to compete, what would now prevent us from not allowing Michael Phelps to compete? And that raises obviously a real interesting ethical conundrum there. So one of the questions that you were – go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is sports doomed, right? I don't see any way out of this. It seems like either it opens the door for enhanced – people to play, and then you have a very unlevel playing field and very odd results in sports for the foreseeable future, or a great injustice gets what feels like a great injustice gets perpetrated.
Yeah, and I'm with you there. I think it is such an injustice that there has to be some kind of a solution to the problem, and I've thought of a number of things. There's two things I want to speak to here in particular. The first is this particular issue, that of the intersexed individual, and not to speak necessarily of any other particular genetic enhancement or, sorry, genetic endowment, let's say, that Michael Phelps or some other would have, but just realize that we do have to now provision for, and we've been in denial about this for a long time, intersexed persons are not new. There have been intersexed people throughout the whole human condition. We've just kind of been in denial that they're around us and that they exist, or maybe we've simply lacked the capacity to actually be able to identify them. But there is a myth that there has always been this binary of male and female gender assignments. And once we get over that myth and accept the fact that we do have this group of individuals within our society, then I think we'll stand a much better chance of setting things up in a fair way that recognizes their right to compete. And just for context, and I don't, again, please don't quote me, again, even though this is now live on the air, in terms of statistics, but I believe when they gender tests, they can be regular occurrences at events. And if you have, for example, I think at the Atlanta Games, for example, they tested for it out of a field of maybe 250 to 500 athletes, there were definitely at least one or two individuals that were pegged as being intersex. So that gives you an idea of how many actually exist in the general population. So that's one thing. Just we got to kind of come to grips with that. But secondly, and more practically, I suppose, and this even kind of relates to the first point, I got thinking, well, what do we do, for example, in boxing and mixed martial arts? We don't allow the 155-pound fighter to fight the 255-pound fighter. It's ridiculous. No one wants to see that. It's simply not fair. What we do instead is we have different tiers. Different divisions of competition. We've got our lightweights, heavyweights, welterweights, all that. It's such a great idea. No one even questions it anymore. That's how those sports are regulated, and everybody loves it. And I'm wondering if perhaps we need to start thinking about similar sorts of tiers in different sports, whether it be, for example, the all-enhancement league, where there's no holds barred. You can dope yourself up with anything you want so long as it's, eventually legalized, and, of course, as it's so important that it's safe. But secondly, if we're going to get into such things as gene doping and other types of what I would say are purely medical enhancements that should at some point be sanctioned, then we also will need to stratify our athletes based on those particular enhancements. So if swimmers want to give themselves webbed fingers, then we can have the webbed fingers leagues. of swimmers. Again, that might sound a bit ridiculous, but I'm just posing some examples out there so the kinds of things that we might be able to do in terms of being able to stratify athletics in such a way that that the type of athletes or the kind of athletes will be as similar as possible, such that there will be fair play and the so-called level playing field. So hopefully sports is not doomed. I think that we just have to adapt to the changing human form, whether it be changing genders or whether it be changing gender constitutions.
I see a way out. If all else fails, then I think the day that we see myostatin inhibition in grade school, and you know these kids are running around doing things that our athletes can't do. That's the day at which we become very accepting of these things, you know,
right.
and start accepting these things into our sports, because, you know, it would be ridiculous if we've got kids, you know, in junior high running the 100-yard dash faster than Olympic athletes because they can't engage in those things. So I think like you say, it's key that these things are safe, and once we find that they are safe, then they'll be accepted, and then we'll see them in our sports too.
Because there's other issues here in terms of our rights and autonomy as individuals. And one thing particularly, we as transhumanists, we tend to be fairly liberal, perhaps even libertarian in our sense of our rights over our bodies, whether it be our reproductive freedoms or whether it be our morphological freedoms and all that's entailed there. And there's another aspect is that if we have technologies that are proven safe, and if we have informed adults who know what they're getting into and why they want to give themselves these sorts of advantages, there is no reason why we should prevent them from doing so. And at the same time, we should athletic organizations need to provide them with the outlets with which they can still go out and compete against others that are like-minded. Again, I don't think an enhanced individual wants to race against an unenhanced individual. I think I would argue that, aside from some perhaps grossly egotistical individuals, that I think fair play and fair competition is probably the goal of any athlete, to know that they did beat somebody because they did perhaps work the hardest or had the greatest spirit or what have you. So that's my own bias, perhaps. Maybe I might be naive about that, but that's just a general feeling that I have.
Well, I think you're probably right. I think that whether we end up with an all-enhanced league or we end up with very different kinds of body type divisions in sports than we can picture now or however it rolls out, I think it goes on, and probably sports becomes a lot more interesting just because there's so many more different types of people participating than even exist right now. So it's something
right.
really to look forward to. Now, gentlemen, we're at a crossroads here. We've expired 47 minutes of our program, and I have a feeling we're not going to get around to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence this evening with still some words to be said on the subject of enhancement. So, George, with literally tens of people listening live here and others recording, I'm going to ask you, do you think you might come back another time and we'll continue
absolutely.
The discussion? Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so we'll find a Tuesday evening that works for you, and
sure.
we'll pick up that topic. So anyone who tuned in just to hear about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we got you. Ha! Yeah, you listened anyway. I'm sorry, Stephen, that probably wasn't the right way to do that. Take over for me, man.
We're so sorry.
Oh, that's
sorry.
It. Thank you. Yeah. I knew if I went to broadcasting school, they'd teach some of this stuff. Okay, so we'll get around to it. We're on to some really interesting stuff here tonight, though, so stick with us, folks. How about this question? What modification are you personally most looking forward to taking advantage of? So not just are you – let me ask you that question in two parts. What are you most looking forward to seeing generally available, and then what personally you, George Dvorsky, do you want to get in on in terms of human modification?
Sorry, what was the first part of that question?
Just what modification do you look forward to seeing available generally for people because you think it would be a good thing as opposed to yourself?
I think it's the same answer, really, and I'm hoping that my answer actually qualifies as a modification, but for me it's life extension. It absolutely.
That definitely qualifies, yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose even by definition, perhaps it is one of the most radical things that you can do to yourself in terms of modifying your body is that it doesn't age and doesn't die. That's pretty amazing stuff. That's pretty serious. So for me, And the reason for it, I mean, there's, you know, there's existential reasons for it, philosophical reasons, personal reasons, petty reasons, and of course, you know, there are biological reasons as well. And as somebody who's about to turn 40, you know, at that kind of so-called, you know, crossroads now, I suppose, or the middle of the road now in terms of, let's face it, you know, the phrase I'm looking for is over the hill, is you start to notice that, you know what, your body is in fact starting to change a little bit. Even now at the age of 40, I'm certainly noticing that my memory is not what it used to be, which is somewhat alarming to me. And of course, interestingly as well, I've recently started to embark upon some fitness has become very important to me, and speaking of sports and competition, and just knowing that at the age of I'm 39, that knowing that perhaps, you know, I will never be at any kind of a peak performance like, let's say, a 25-year-old would be, that I somehow lament that a little bit as a missed opportunity. So I would certainly hope that that Aubrey is right, and that we can actually not just stop the aging process, but we can actually reverse it as well, and retune our bodies in such a way that they are at a fixed particular state, whether it be a 25-year-old or what have you. That to me would be absolutely number one with a bullet on my list of things that I would hope to do for myself. And I suppose perhaps tangentially, again harkening back to the whole memory thing, if I could also have another sort of an enhancement, it would be definitely an increased memory. And again, I think what our issue with memory is not that we can't remember; it's simply our ability to recall is hindered. Not just because we age, but even in general, I think as humans, I think our ability to recall and our memory is actually quite weak. And I know that there are perhaps some problems with recall that is too good. So maybe we can find, for example, a nice middle of the road, fine tuning of our memory, such that we're still able to be functional in society and not be overwhelmed with our memories and all the flooding in the memories. But that's a big one for me. In terms of, let's say, intelligence enhancement, yeah, to a certain degree. Of course, that might sound rather petty in consideration of discussions of the post-human, where our cognition might be completely off the scale. So for some reason, it seems right now a little less appealing to me, given I think that I can't really conceive of what that's actually going to be. So I think that's just a limitation of my mind as it is right now. But yeah, right now for me, that's the whole life extension thing, and that hopefully is something that start to see more of. You know, I'd love to see, for example, that there are more people living beyond 100 and 110, 120. That for me, would be an indication that we're actually getting somewhere with that. Clearly, we're not there yet because people are still dying, obviously. Although we are certainly extending we are extending healthy lifespan beyond certainly what we've ever been able to accomplish before.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about that is it seems that we've have turned or are beginning to turn a corner, at least socially, culturally, around that. And I think that the baby boom generation might have been drivers of that to a certain extent, just in their absolute denial of the fact that they could get older. there's this just expectation that you don't get old, that I think doesn't really work out because you actually do get old, but it has helped in certain ways. You've got the idea that there's nothing in the least bit wrong with venturing out in a new career at age 40 or at age 50 or at age 60, right? I don't know if you've heard that 50 is the new 30, right? That one
right.
Becomes increasingly meaningful for me each year, actually. that kind of stuff. And I just blogged the other day on something I found over on Michael Anisimov's blog over on Accelerating Future. The World Future Society put out their predictions for the years, I think it was 2010 to 2025, and one of them was that by 2025, we would achieve essentially for, I guess, people born then, actuarial escape velocity, that anyone born in 2025 and beyond would have a year of life expectancy added to their life for every year they live. So you've hit the, you know.
That's interesting, because I've heard some claims that we've already actually achieved that. Maybe not for
Well, I like that. Okay. That, whoever said that is wise and good, yes. But
I think about I mean, let's think this through for a little bit. My kids were born in 97 and 99 respectively, and there's a part of me believes that they've actually hit that so-called escape velocity, because let's say in our deepest and darkest and most pessimistic predictions that they wouldn't live, let's say, past 100 to 110. We're talking about the 22nd century.
Right.
And I don't have to remind you guys about what the Hans Moravec and the Ray Kurzweils of the world are predicting in terms of singularities and other such paradigmatic changes to human society. So I think that talking about 2025 is perhaps a bit cautious. Let's just put it that way, I think.
Well, to me, what was interesting about that was that it came from the World Futures Society, who are not known for their
right.
they're not a Kurzweil type organization. They don't predict things like that. I would never have thought that they would think that actuarial escape velocity was ever going to happen. So
fair enough, and your point is very well taken, and they are notorious for that. I think even worse than that, though, is when you get into the kinds of extrapolations that are made by, for example, the United Nations or the World Health Organization, and you start to see their graphs. There's talking about 200-year spans of predicting human population growth and, of course, aging. And it's like, really? Are you really sure that that's in fact the case? I mean, talk about that's out of touch. That's grossly out of touch. But that's interesting to hear that the World Future Society, I guess, credit where credit is due, and I suppose baby steps are important at this point.
Yeah, well, the fact that they're coming along, I think, is just part of the overall trend that we're becoming more tolerant of the idea of life extension, I guess, was kind of my point there. But
yeah.
I have to address it since you brought it up, just giving one more idea back to Michael and Isimov on the subject of the 22nd century. Of course, the 22nd century will never come, because we'll all be going 6 million times faster here in about the middle part of this coming century, and subjectively, we'll never make it to the 22nd century.
I do recall that argument of his. It's one of my favorites, actually. That's a great thought.
Mine too, yeah. Okay, well, our final question, just to bring us all down here right at the end of the show, I should have done these in reverse order, but any enhancements that you're not so much looking forward to, any things that you think should be avoided?
Sure, there's a couple. One, I suppose, is I guess the science fiction type fear, the dystopic type fear that we would, for example, put devices in our bodies, particularly in our brain, that could be controlled by somebody else, and by virtue of that, control our own behavior. So take, for example, a good science fiction treatment of this is Ghost in the Shell, where you have people have brains in this future that are kind of still half biological, but there's still enough cybernetic components to it that allows these individuals to tap into the web at that particular point. And because they are logged into the web and accessible through the web, they've now made themselves vulnerable. And there are some individuals in the society who have had their brains hacked into, and their identities changed, and they've actually had them perform specific tasks, obviously against their will. And just so you don't think that that is as outlandish as a thought as it might sound, I did speak to the neuroscientist and transhumanist polymath Anders Sandberg about this, and he did recognize it as a potential problem. And he and I worked for a little bit on some... what might now be considered perhaps some naive prescriptions against it, but we did talk about setting up some kind of a firewall, for example, that could prevent some kind of an attack. But as we all know, any kind of a firewall has its limitations and has its vulnerabilities. So that is a concern, I suppose, because let's face it, it is kind of a modification that we do see coming and would arguably want to have our minds actually physically connected to the web or some kind of noosphere where our thoughts are transmitted to other thoughts or where we can actually manipulate, let's say, objects in that particular cyberspace. And to make ourselves vulnerable in that way could be potentially problematic. So that's one thing.
Yeah, the safeguards are going to have to be in place for that. Well, George, it's been great talking with you. We're just about out of time, so I'm going to have to let that be the last word. Thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to having you back on very soon. We'll get to the second part of our discussion.
You got it.
All right, Stephen, very quickly, what's our music this evening?
Well, before I get to that, I got to say real quick, Brian Wong at his website, Next Big Future, is reporting that 2 o'clock this Thursday, NASA is going to announce the results of their Moon Mineralogy Mapper. It's basically a probe that was sent along to the moon. At any rate, that there is a lot of water on the moon.
Sweet. Water on the moon.
You know, lots of water on the moon. So, at any rate, that's extremely important, obviously.
Breaking news. Okay, good.
Breaking news, thanks to our friend over at Next Big Future. Okay, tonight's music is White Lies by Azatron.
Light Lies by Azatron. All right, well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks to everyone who listened live, to all our friends in the chat room, and to everyone listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next Tuesday evening. Until then, live to see it.